This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. This is episode 53 of season 16. I'm speaking from the basement of my house in beautiful Ben Lomond, California, with the illustrious Brian Young, a programmer. What are things we say about you?
Programmer.
Digital artist.
Digital artist. Tinkerer. Everything.
And as you can tell, it's a slightly different format show today because we're not using a Google Doc to drive us at all, so I don't know your bio. I guess I don't know by heart.
Yeah, why didn't we do the doc? Where's my 20 minutes to get prepped? Where's my cue time?
You didn't get prepped, huh?
No. You took that 20 minutes so we could talk about just stuff.
Did you
show
off my new MacBook? Yes, I did want to take it out and get your fresh feedback on it. So I love it in a lot of ways. The new MacBook, the touchpad, the touchscreen above the keyboard, totally cool. The escape key is not a problem at all. The unlocking it when it works to use your fingerprint to unlock it is great, and I'm looking forward to other features being accessible that way.
Okay, so the most important feature to me, I've had, two different MacBooks of recent generations, though generations before this, and I've noticed that the biggest problem I've been having is when I open up my MacBook, mm-hmm. my MacBook Pro. These are all MacBook Pros. When I open it up and I want to do something with it, I have to wait for the login screen and I have to wait for it to wake up. That time has been getting longer and longer and longer. Like in the late 90s, early in the mid 2000s, they were saying you can open up your PowerBook and it'll get running in less than a second and you can start doing things on it. That time has gotten longer and longer for me. In fact, sometimes it's gotten into the minutes where the thing just won't even respond. So that sounds like something wrong, but it's commonly in 4, 5, 6 seconds before it really is responding.
Seconds doesn't sound like that long.
So,
but you notice it?
Yeah. I definitely notice it.
You want me to sleep this and see what
happens? I'm just wondering, is that
yeah, so again,
a problem?
Yeah. I so frequently got this machine that I haven't had all the time to have the daily experience activity. Every time I've opened this, I've been doing I've got to install Sublime. I've been doing things the entire time, getting Xcode working, getting my certs onto this. So there's been a lot of thinking about the machine rather than just experiencing it.
Right.
And so I don't have the habitual wait information queued up. I haven't gotten frustrated yet.
You know what?
I could put it to sleep now and see.
Yeah, try it. Right. This was never a problem for me until I had my iPad Pro, the large one. And that thing, it'll open up and start working for me from the just Touch ID in less than a second.
Interesting.
And all of a sudden, my computer, my workhorse of the machine that I do most of my work on throughout all of my career is becoming a problem.
Seems slow.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, so I've put this machine to sleep. I'm opening it up. I don't have it on plug-in power. The lights light up.
Give it the thumb.
The mouse is there. Well, it hasn't cued me to give me the thumb, so I don't know what's happening there.
Yeah, that's pretty slow.
Yeah, and look at the screen.
Yeah.
Black.
Let's see. It. I don't know whether this is a hardware thing or whether the OS
It's actually not giving me access. Yeah, this has kind of been my experience with this machine. It feels like they weren't exactly ready.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So
now I don't have a screen. I don't have any vision on it. I mean, there's no picture on the screen. Keyboard's lit up. Yep.
It's still going.
I think it's just stuck.
So you can pound the command key all you want.
Yeah, nothing's happening.
Yeah. So I don't know.
Awesome radio? Sorry. Go on.
I don't know if this is a hardware problem or a software problem because at the company I work at, we have a Mac product and the OS releases since this was released. So the OSs that support that touch bar have all had
trouble.
Pretty severe troubles causing all sorts of problems.
I mean, they did something interesting. Like this touch bar is kind of cool. It is a second computer, and it does have interface. You know, it's comparable to the iPhone and the watch, right? The Apple Watch, in the sense that they're different CPUs running the guts of them.
Yeah, I'd say watch over the iPhone. Yeah, maybe the initial iPhone.
No, I'm saying the watch and the
phone.
Oh,
you mean it's a partner device?
It's a partner device. Yeah. This happens to be the same case. Yeah, I'm gonna have to hard reboot this machine, which I don't know how to do. Actually, I think I do. I think I just hold down the.
Yeah.
Oh, it did come on the. So it didn't ask me for my key print. So as soon as I touched that, it unlocked. So maybe that's what I should be doing. It just wasn't telling me to do it.
Yeah, you're just novice.
Yeah. In any case, the MacBook Pro has the new one has a touch sensor on the bar. All right, let's move on to away from what we're talking about here. I want to talk to you about. Did you listen to Michael Polson and me talk about flat buffers?
Flat buffers. Last yeah.
Did you listen to that episode?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Geeky. Yeah. So I thought it was interesting that at first when he started going through this that it wasn't a matter of data throughput, that compressing down the text that JSON is and putting it through the wire, putting it through the network, pretty much gets around the same range as just the straight flat buffer.
Because of the gzip aspect, yeah.
But the problem was in the processing speed that it took, how much CPU time it actually took to manage the JSON versus just straight pushing data around. And that sounds like a big win. It seems cool. And
to be clear, the real saving there is on the server side, in the sense that if a client has to parse it, it takes more processing time. It might not be a big deal because the clients that are better at it can handle it. But when you are dealing with the stitching, you can't deliver the data until all that processing has happened, the server-side aspect of stitching, that is where you want to be really efficient. And so that was the big win in reality. And he was still talking about that as a client, so it was a little confusing that there's this middleware node thing that does this stitching.
So it wasn't clear. When he called it a middleware,
that
node code, that node app, is sucking data down from other sources.
Yeah, and other microservices of Netflix, right, or whatever company it'd be at.
Mm-hmm. And did he translate those to flat buffers, or was he pulling in JSON?
No, he had those other services delivering flat
buffers. Okay, so he was pulling down flat buffers,
right.
Maybe making an adjustment, just flipping some bits within the buffer, and then sending it on.
Right.
And that's where the big savings was.
Yeah, and in fact, I shouldn't say that there was JSON coming down for the subs, but those sub calls are smaller calls because there are things like, I want bookmark for this one bookmark, right? The bookmark means the position you've last played, and I want it for this one video. And so that one request might be a JSON fragment, but it's a very small fragment, and then you're kind of putting together. But the memory storage of the node instance, he was never creating all the objects in memory. He was actually creating the flat buffer as he went, kind of. So anyway, I'm sure this, for people that weren't that into it, it was a long, arduous discussion. The other aspect of this is one of those episodes that I just did by myself, the beginning of it, and had, kind of read some stuff. And since that date, I've been going, God, that wasn't the best content. And I'm always concerned about the show being too technical for people.
Yeah. This really started out as a public show for non-geeks to kind of get into it.
Yeah, it was a call-in show to help people with their computers, how to check email and stuff.
Yeah, but at the same time, we've gotten some great compliments when we've gotten as technical as we can go, yeah.
Yeah, and then recently we had some questions about our political, like we've been leaning more political. And I think that because this is a labor of love and because it's, we're not pulling income from this thing at all, I'm just going to keep doing the show to make it interesting for me and the people that I invite on. And I'm hoping that people will follow along with that. So I won't deviate too much, most likely, but I'm not going to concern myself that much about it being too technical or whatever. At the same time, I do have people that come to me and listen to the show and feel like my sister Adriana, who, knows how to manage a database, but she's not a programmer. And she said to me that the show seems to have been getting more technical and we don't clarify some ideas. And I said, well, you'll love this episode then.
Well, and that's been a conscious thing that as we went to a podcast, we assumed that our audience was to a certain technical level that we didn't have to explain each term.
Every time we say USB.
Yeah, exactly. But please give us feedback. Let us know what you guys and gals are interested in so
definitely.
That we don't miss that beat.
Yeah, and you can contact us up at geekspeak.org. And, the email address is just geeks@geekspeak.org. And I'm Lyle on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Lyle, so it's easy to send me notes, and I'm open for direct messages. And, Brian, you're on Twitter as?
Brian C. Young.
Brian C. Underscores or anything? Just
no underscores, word. Brian C.
Brian
I
C.
think
Young.
It's Brian C. Shoot, I signed up for that one too long ago.
We'll have to fix that in a minute and get that addressed. All right, so Brian C.
Well, finish off flat buffers, the thing I thought was interesting is that it all sounded great. I like the optimization of it. And then you brought up the whole point of why we ever used text in the first place, which was just the ease of being able to see what you're working with.
Yeah.
And as soon as you start working with somebody else's API, I would hate having that flat buffer.
Yeah. Yeah. But keep in mind that what they would deliver to you, what the flat buffer system delivers to you is bindings for that data in the native application layer you're working on. So if you were using Swift, for example, you would actually get a Swift object that would be pre-built for you that would actually be able to be a class that you loaded that would access that data. So for your perspective on what it looked like wouldn't really matter because you'd have that code delivered to you. Kind of like how 4D's Wakanda system works where the model actually gets generated for you on the fly.
Yeah, if that was true, then.
That's the plan.
But when you're dealing with APIs, you're hacking it and trying to actually figure it out without as much support as you would like.
Yeah, so the thing that's interesting to me about this flat buffer methodology is that If it's done well, the end user developer doesn't necessarily need to know much about it. And I've talked about on the show that my sideline project has actually been using this database project from Google that Google purchased. What do you call the name of it?
Firebase.
Firebase, right. And how much I've liked being able to use that. Now, its interface is JSON. JSON's actually happening in the background. But you've actually become this kind of expert on Apple's solution to the same problem, which is iCloud, iData. What was it?
No. The API is called CloudKit.
CloudKit.
And it's JSON for communicating as well. But the developer never sees that JSON if they're doing Objective-C or Swift, the Cocoa layer.
Yeah. What are you seeing instead? You're seeing just classes that are data objects?
Yeah, it's all translated into a dictionary-like object, a key-value object that you consume. And
do you think it's a good, now that you've been doing a lot of development on it, do you think it's a good database layer?
Oh, you mean, well, I don't call it database layer.
Well, why not?
I mean, it's a dumb server persistence layer. They bill it as a transportation layer. So it's transporting it from your app up to the cloud.
But you're building an app that has a large data model, and that data model is in CloudKit.
So. Yeah, so it's a cloud database, right. So yes, it's like that. What do I think about it? I think it's really interesting to try to build an app where the server is dumb. There is no logic running on the server. The server can't do anything for you but hold.
A couple episodes, me and Miles talking about database layers and how he thinks database layers should be more intelligent and be. Did you hear about that whole episode?
I heard it.
it's completely opposite of what his perspective.
Well, it is because there's so many. Well, okay. So let's say we're making an app that is you and me friends. It's a social app.
Okay.
So you're going to friend me. You're going to say, Brian's now my friend after all these years. And if you're doing a database in the cloud that's smart, you would just say, okay, I friend Brian. And whatever data objects need to exist, the server can create them and make sure both of our phones now have them.
Okay. That's the pattern I've grew up with.
Right. This is what servers have always done. Sure. A server is smart. This is nothing more than your phone has to create whatever objects need to exist and send them up to the server.
Oh, I see. And so then, my application layer is handling the creation of all that stuff.
Right. So the logic, the smarts of the cloud have to be running on your phone. And you see this in lots of Apple products now. So in Photos right now, when it scans your photo library to find all of the pictures of dogs and all the pictures on the beach, it's doing that on each individual device. It's not even syncing that data yet between devices.
Wow.
But
And there's a big reason that Apple touts that is that it's taking advantage of these strong, powerful machines that we've got in our pockets.
Right.
But also, they no longer know if you have pictures of dogs. If they did it on their cloud infrastructure, you'd have to upload the picture and then the calculation would have to occur. And then they actually know what's in your photo. With this other way of doing it, they don't know, which is big on their privacy aspect, a big selling point that Apple's been touting.
It is, but the system I'm working with is public data, unencrypted data, no matter how you slice it.
So it's not that important from that perspective.
Yeah, from that perspective.
But the pattern of doing processing on the phone seems to be Apple's pattern. The thing that doesn't work, or the reason why this kind of works but feels wrong to me and would really feel wrong to Miles, is that if you do it that way, what you're doing is you're saying, I trust the client to give truth to the server. And that methodology is not the traditional data integrity methodology. You have, in a traditional world, you've got the home base and that thing knows it all. And a little client's connect and say, I'd like to do this. And the server says, yes, you may. And it's very, you just hit your head on the ceiling of my
office. No, I hit my headphones.
Oh, good. Nice. That's why I give you padding. I can give you a helmet too. There's a helmet over on the wall for welding. So there's definitely this idea that the client being the one that's in charge seems to go against the database model. And I do like part of it, and I think it's kind of also problematic. And one of the reasons why I think it's problematic is traditionally in data development or in application development with servers, you can't trust the client because someone might play with the client. Someone might hack it and mess with it. And so like in a web browser application, which all these online applications actually came originally kind of, or my growth from it exactly, has been from a web browser, right? And in a web browser, you just can't trust it. It's easy to hack and change it.
Yeah, the user can see the logic, they can see the data, anything that's there, they can do something with.
Right. But the truth is, if you're dealing with your application running on an iPhone, as you as a developer are running it, you have to get it signed by Apple for it to run on the device keys have to be sent onto the device to make it work, there's actually a whole encryption pattern there to trust the code that's running.
Yeah, outside of jailbreaking, that data is safe on the client. But jailbreaking still exists. If this is very sensitive information, it can still be gotten to.
Well, so let me ask you this. In a situation that was the social app we were just talking about, like if we were making a social app together and somebody else kind of got a jailbroken phone and kind of knew your code and started playing, could they completely change our relationship to a hate relationship without us being involved? I mean, you still have to do some kind of layer
to protect that. When it comes to this, that I don't know if jailbreaking would interfere with this or not. I wonder if it would. I'd love to test that. There is a encrypted communication between the app and the server. So if jailbreaking can allow the jailbreaker to hack into and swizzle the code without interrupting that, then yeah, they could. They could change all sorts of data on the server, which makes server integrity or data integrity a nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, in a traditional data model, you've saw it and it as a certain user, and that user's ability to do data changing is all based on the rules about that user.
Well, that kind of access model still exists.
It does, but if that access model exists... Right, I see what you're saying. You could set it up to be that structure such that only I can change my records. But of course, when it's a friendship model, both of us kind of have to be involved in the creation
of that. That's inherently public data.
Yeah, interesting. Or shared private data, which of course makes it too intelligent for iCloud's iKit to work, right?
Right.
Yeah. Cool. Now we've really lost people if they were not interested in databases.
I didn't think we were going there. I don't know why we got there.
What else we got this week?
So speaking of the cloud and services, a couple things came together this week. First of all, I got a gift. I got not a Amazon Echo. I got a Google Home for Christmas.
Oh, we can compete with each other.
Yeah.
What do you think of your Google Home?
It's pretty limited. It doesn't know how to do very much, and it knows how to do a lot less since I'm not totally in the Google universe. It can't read my calendars.
Why aren't you? Your calendars aren't there?
I don't know.
And your contacts aren't there?
No, they're not.
Ah, dude.
I had so many problems with both of those. I tried to get them in one universe, which was the Apple one, and still had problems.
Okay, so you got to... Okay. Anyways, so you're saying that your contacts currently are being seeked through Apple's contact system?
Yeah.
Is that how you're doing
it? Yeah, I've had no end of trouble with that, too.
Yeah, so... The only trouble I've had with that is that when you get a new iOS device and you sign into iCloud, it turns that on automatically and you have to turn it off. That's the only problem I have with that because I do not use it because it is bad. I'm surprised you're doing it that way. It's really interesting. And it's really funny that you now have a device that needs all that connectivity.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a very nice music player. It can play music. And my kids love playing... what do you call it? Mad Libs, and it has a trivia game on it.
Does it have... that's cool. Mad Libs sounds like a fun one to do.
Mad Libs and trivia.
And does it say, give me a noun?
A noun, adjective, verb.
And when you say the noun back, does it repeat it? Or does it
it goes through it fairly quickly, and then when you do the whole,
the playback.
Reciting the playback of the Mad Lib, then you hear what it really heard you. But it's been accurate. The voice... recognition has been really good.
It doesn't use a recording of your voice.
No.
Okay. Interesting. Let's get back to this iCloud Google contacts syncing thing for a second.
This show's not going to go anywhere that I intended, is it?
Wait, what's wrong?
No. I like it.
Do you currently do you share contacts between multiple people, or do you always have them on your own contacts?
Yes. So in Apple's universe, you can share contacts between multiple people by having multiple logins to contacts. You can set up one phone to look for two different contact databases.
And where does that second contact database exist? Or are you saying that on your phone you have your contacts and you also have iCloud contacts logged into your wife's account?
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, so we've got a shared group of contacts, and then we have my contacts. I haven't set my wife's phone up to have just her contacts.
What iCloud account are your shared ones under?
Oh, goodness, I don't remember.
Or do you have another iCloud account?
It's two different accounts on my phone. On her phone, it's one account.
Awesome.
But that's not where all the problem's been. The problem just historically... Apple has not synced. First of all, I've had my addresses in an Apple contact database since I got rid of my Palm in 1997.
You're talking about like the CVS card file format of Apple's?
Not CVS.
CVS? Isn't?
You're thinking another format. But yes.
Whatever the address book contacts thing. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's been in there and scrambled and changed. And at one point, there were phone numbers from the wrong people.
I've written code to get out of that system. Just because it was
so painful.
I like
the idea of it so much. I've stuck with it all
the time. It'd just be great if Apple was good at services.
Well, historically, I would build these systems on my own. I would cobble things together.
Yeah.
And I had a great music system that was all cobbled together. And then iTunes came out. And after a couple of years, I'm like, I give in. I'm going to do Apple's way. And I lost some features, but it was great because it was simple. And this happened over and over again with multiple things.
Yeah.
So when Context came along and was managing it, it was great. But I keep running into these problems. And it's a year after it's been scrambled that I actually realize it's been scrambled.
Yeah.
Anyways, so
No, the scrambling is really bad. The merging of Context is not very good with the Apple stuff. With Google stuff, the merging Context is fantastic.
Yeah.
I've only had like one real problem on merging Context with Google. I mean, the one issue is that when you move from Contacts, that slowly degraded your quality of your data, and then you go into Google and you suck it in. At that point, you might have to go through like hundreds of address books saying, is this the same and as this, you know, over and over again. But once it finally works, it's pretty clean. It's pretty slick. I have to say, though, that Google is really bad at surfacing the contacts in general. It's hard to get to them. So in Inbox, for example, which is Google's new Gmail, there's an Inbox version of that.
Is that a web app or is that a...
There's a phone app, but actually the web, you can actually change the way your address books, the way Google works.
Mm-hmm.
There's the old way and the new way, and I've migrated to the new way, and there's different ways of searching your inbox. Anyway, when you're there and you see a name that somebody sent you a message, you see their name in there, and you expand the email addresses of all the different email addresses in the to field or whatever, because you're in a multiple, you cannot click on that to see their address book that you have. You have to copy that and find it. It's just, they're not good at surfacing the actual contact information inside email client. You can send and forward and all that, but you can't find their phone number from there. Things like that are really irritating.
Which is funny, because to set up the Google Home Amazon Echo-like device that I have.
It's called Google Home, yes.
People don't know that as much.
Okay.
People know about the Echo now. To set that up, you have to use the Google Home app on your phone. So I go through the setup process, and it asks me a few things, and I set up Pandora on my account and everything like that. And then I'm into the app and seeing what I can do. There is no place in that app to go back and remove the Pandora account or change to another Pandora account. There's no place to do a bunch of things.
Yeah,
I just haven't figured out how to do it. I'm a relatively smart person, but they just don't surface all this stuff.
I got to say that Google's user interface is not as good as it could be. They have done a few things that are really great. So, for example, the Chrome browser on iOS and also the email client on iOS. Having multiple Google accounts is really, really easy. Google Maps as well, YouTube. Actually, I don't know about YouTube. You can toggle out of your current account and switch over to a different account. Google Drive stuff, Docs and things like that, really easy. And I do that all the time because I've got my personal Gmail account, I got my GeekSpeak Gmail account, and I've got my Netflix Gmail account. And I go between them depending on my calendars and all those things. All that works pretty well. But I agree that sometimes you just can't find the setting you need to find. It's really irritating. But come on, Google's bad UI in some situations is trumped
by the fact that their cloud services work.
Yes, that Apple's cloud services are just abysmal. I have to say the one more thing, though, about cloud services and such. The one problem I'm having is the photo management.
Oh, really?
Oh, man.
Wait, Google's?
Both. Because I have Google backend all my photos now. So on my machine that has my photo library, my 200,000 photos or something in Lightroom, I connect up my hard drive and I bring it to a good connection and I say, hey, Google Photos, please back up my photos. And it starts just crawling through those things. And then a little bit later, I change machines, and all of a sudden that count increases again, like it still needs to back things up. It's like backing up multiple copies of it, but I don't think in the interface it's not really doing that. It just is processing them again, because the photo that's on my disk is not, of course, the version that gets up in the cloud, and it doesn't know what that version is until it processes the photo. So they have a little bit of problems there. So they're not copying, they're not uploading they're not saving two copies in the cloud of my photo of you at my wedding, right? But they are processing that photo every time it gets a pass through the photo system to find out if it is uploaded. So that's a little irritating. But more than that, if you have the Google Photos app on your iOS device and you have iCloud Photos, what occurs is that it slowly just gets new copies of all of your photos and uploads them.
This sounds like it could get into an infinite loop.
It's bad. It's really bad. So when you ask for a photo on iOS from the operating system, when it's iCloud Photos, it doesn't actually have the photo. So the interface to that, from a programming perspective, is, hey, I want that photo data. And so it gives you that photo data, downloads it from the cloud, puts it on the phone for a little bit, and then you can upload it. So the Google backup thing is doing that through all the photos that are in my iCloud library, which is all the photos I've ever taken with an iOS device, which is a lot of photos. And it's frustrating. I was at an event. Yeah.
Well, so do you have the photo sharing turned on for iCloud where it doesn't download all of your photos?
Not on my phone. I can't have that on my phone, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, on my computer, yes, I do have it downloading all of my computer.
You know, but you can't download them all on your phone.
No, so it's not possible.
But to Google Photos, when it looks in the library, it doesn't know which ones are downloaded and which aren't.
That's right. So it just slowly crawls through and asks
and
for them.
And has to pull them down. Mm-hmm. And then the operating system's continually managing which one to delete, which one to put back or keep in there.
So last year we did an iOS device, mobile talk at Netflix. We invited people to come and talk about animation and such. Did you come to that? It was really kind of cool. I think you're out of town.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You always do the cool things when I'm out of town.
I'm so sorry. So we had, given free food and all that and try to get mobile developers to come and talk with us and stuff. And two guys were chatting with me about the animation stuff I was chatting about on iOS, and I was kind of demoing stuff. And I said, where do you guys work? They're like, I work at Google. I'm like, oh, cool. What do you do? We work on the Photos app on iOS. I'm like, okay, tell me what's going on here. And I start chatting. He's like, you've got to turn off Apple Cloud. Like, don't do that. And they were vehemently like, please get away from iCloud photo backup. But I got to use it. It's so nice and convenient to have it go from my phone to my computer. You know?
Right.
Hey, so well, I haven't
and
done
do your
it.
Apple, do you use the Apple TV for that too?
I haven't done photos on Apple TV. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maggie keeps on disconnecting the Apple TV and putting it away. Because
what?
Because
oh, also, what's this black box? Oh, I'll just put it just,
all we watch on our TV is Netflix. That's all we watch, right? And YouTube, right?
Netflix and YouTube,
and
yeah.
And my TV has Netflix and YouTube built into it. It doesn't need the iOS device. And the only reason
have you ever had an event where you wanted to see some live news or something like that or some live coverage?
Live coverage on the Apple TV?
I have got the older version, the Gen 2 version, and it still has apps that do that. So, yeah, it's been like the debates. I don't think you could watch this on YouTube, could you?
I didn't watch the debates, man. I'm sorry.
What are you doing?
You totally could watch them. I was at a bar, actually. I didn't watch the debates.
At a bar would have been better.
I watched the debates online somehow, as I recall, live. And it might have been through YouTube.
Yeah, yeah. I
only watched one of the debates, by the way. They were too depressing. I went to a bar. And it was the first time in my life I was like, oh, this is what people say when they say, I need a drink. And I got a drink that night in that way. What were we talking about?
So Google Home.
Yeah, Google Home.
Are we going to do any news? So
I don't know.
So here's the thing. Google Home, it does like Amazon Echo and everything and any other assistant. It's listening for the keyword. It's listening for, hey, Google. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I just do that?
Hey, thing in the wall. Yeah.
And then at that point, it starts sending your voice up to the cloud to, be able to do commands with the voice assistant that actually lives on the cloud.
Right. Because the processing of... the analyzing the voice for natural language is actually an intensive process that doesn't happen on the device.
Yeah, for the most part. I think they're still sneaking a few of those on there. Okay. Anyways, so in the news is the fact that a murder recently happened that investigators have subpoenaed? Actually, I don't know if I can use that word in this case, have asked Amazon to give them all the data that they have, all the recording of the voice during the time period of the murder. And Amazon has said no, but this, of course, opens up that Pandora's box that everybody's been worried about, the fact that we have a wonderful NSA listening device sitting right in our living rooms now.
Right. And the feedback based on this is, okay, you're concerned about spying, and yet you're putting a device in your house that spies on you.
You and I both have these, and our kids love playing with them.
Yes.
So is this the right trade-off?
But I've got to say that the device is not always sending audio up.
Right.
It's after you've done blah, the command word that initiates it, then it starts recording. So they're not going to get any data. I mean, the device doesn't have data prior to the murder unless the murder was like, how should I stab my wife? I mean, whatever the murder was, right? It's not going to be recording that conversation, right?
Right. The amount of audio that they keep in the buffer is, I think, 10 seconds long.
Oh, I see. They are always buffering.
They're buffering it, but they throw the buffer out. It's just, watching TV with a pause button. So they've got that buffer. They're not sending that up to the cloud until it gets the keyword, and then they send that up to the cloud. So I guess it's possible during the murder that the murderer could have said something that triggered that, but I doubt it.
Okay, so why, when you say the buffering, isn't the buffering only for the command word? Because by the time that, okay, and then you continue recording and send up the other thing. Yeah, I don't think they're going to get much data out of it. It's, of course, a perfect headline news story to do. Oh, you're having a device that's listening. Now, but the other side of that is that no devices, especially complicated ones, are perfectly secure. And therefore, it's possible that some malware will exist at some point that will start using that device as a listening device all the time.
And we've covered a ton of stories about Internet of Things devices being hacked.
Right.
And so far, we haven't heard anything related to the Amazon Echo, Google Home, Apple TV.
These companies know the risk, and they're going to spend a lot of money making sure those things are secure. So I'm not really concerned about the Amazon Echo as much as I am concerned about even my laptop. Am I more concerned about my laptop?
Okay, so you say that, except for we have an example in Uber that is, I mean, they rely on people trusting them and using them, and they have sensitive information like your location data. And we've had several stories recently about how they've been cavalier about your
location. The data management and stuff.
Data management.
In the office.
In the office. Mm-hmm. This happened several years ago as well, and it came, they said, oh, no, we're going to institute policies. And then all of a sudden that news comes out that people are looking up locations
again. But keep in mind that what Amazon is attempting to do with their device, with their cylinder, is to make it so that you are more easily purchasing stuff through Amazon, right? Like, that's what it's about. And so for this to succeed at all, people have to feel really trustworthy about this.
Right. Their entire business model of this device is based on you trusting it.
Yeah. I gotta say, the most fun I have with the Echo is having people come over that haven't played with it yet.
Have you installed its skills?
I have installed a few skills. We have a watering the garden skill because we've got a Wi-Fi device that waters our garden for us. So you can say, hey, you know, thing in the corner, tell Rochet to water my garden for an hour and it will do it. It's kind of neat. But the app is faster on the phone. And you can see
it's faster
what's on,
to pull it
on.
Out on your phone and,
well,
and turn on.
I shouldn't say it's faster. It feels more reliable. The skill set that program that has been written is a one-way program. It doesn't say it's currently on. It doesn't have a great interface, a verbal interface.
It's like an IR remote that you don't know what state the thing's in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it doesn't toggle it for you. You say it's on, turn on, whatever. But it's kind of, I'd rather see, like in the app, which is not great either, of the Ricochet watering system, you can actually see all the different zones and turn them on for different lengths of time. You can see that, oh, zone one is on right now, and then after this 10 minutes, zone two will turn on because it cycles through them. And it just feels better to see it visually rather than know that something's thinking for you.
So what you would really want is just a program that would run, a preset watering program.
We do that in the summer. We do that
What I mean is like, oh, it's been dry for 2 days. Whatchamacallit, run watering program one.
Yeah, you could do that kind of, but you can't name them as well. You have to say turn on zone two. On the phone, we've renamed zone two to be tomatoes, the year that zone two is tomatoes.
But you couldn't do
on the vocal one, you can't say turn on tomatoes. You have to say turn on zone two. So you have to memorize what zone numbers are rather than the names of them.
It's just not well written.
It's just not perfect. And the reason it's not perfect is because, of course, the amount of people that have this same product I have, the Rocio or whatever it is, watering system, is a certain size. And the people that also have the Echo device as well and want to use it is a lot smaller. So for them to do much besides just appease Amazon and say it's there, it's not a lot of feedback for the company. It doesn't help them a lot to make that product. So anyway, the other day, though, I had my sister over, my younger sister, comes, and we were talking. I showed everybody Echo at one point. We mentioned Amazon because what happens is someone says, oh, set a timer so I can boil cook the tomatoes or whatever. And we have a lot of tomatoes there. And I just, every time I'm in the kitchen, I want to do it. I tell the Amazon Echo thing to do a timer for me because it's so easy, right? It's in the kitchen. So it's not like even on my phone, I can tell Siri to do it too. But of course then it goes with me. So I always do that. And that's how people learn about it. And then we do the Echo thing. And we tell people all this stuff, right? Simon Says is really fun to play with. Anyway, so my sister was talking about how much she loves some kind of lemon curry. Lemon custard. Custard? Lemon something.
Lemon custard, yeah.
Lemon, it's not custard. It's like in a jar. It's like a jelly.
Not
I'll have to look at my Amazon history. Anyway, so I was like, hey, Echo thing, how much is this? And it told me what it recommended, and I said, you want to buy it? Because it always asks, you want to buy it? And this time I said yes. It was the first time I was like, yeah, I'll buy it, because it was kind of fun. And the next day it showed up at our house.
The next day, lovely.
I spoke something in my kitchen about something I wanted for my sister, and the next day it came to my house. That was weird. And of course, it came to my wife's account because it's connected to her account all the time, not mine.
It wasn't even addressed to you.
It wasn't addressed to me. I had to give it to her, and I had to wait for her to open it and all that.
No, that's really cool. I love that moment when that happens. Now I'm not going to go back in time and talk about that moment. But so the thing about the Echo is that it's supposed to have all these skills.
Yeah.
And Google Home, I've heard that the technology seems to be better, and I feel like the voice comprehension is really good, but it can hardly do anything. I can play music, I can play these games, and I can call an Uber, and if I had my calendar and contacts hooked up, it would at least understand those. But I can't shop with it, which actually I'm glad about that.
I think it's okay.
And
you have no idea how many times we talked about something, like asked, hey, what kind of insect is this, and describe the, you know, we ask Wikipedia questions to it all the time. It's great. Right. And so many times you accidentally, it's like talking about tissue paper, and then it says, we recommend Kleenex. It's $14 for a case of 30. Would you like me to mail it to you? And everybody in the room goes, no, at the same time.
You know what that is? Those are the ads I'm trying to keep my kids from seeing on TV by watching Netflix. So
you can't do anything with it. There's no skills. The Google one has no skills.
But I'm right in the fact that you can't add skills to it yet. You haven't heard anything about that.
I haven't heard of that, but I thought it had I am assuming that it's going to be a good developer platform and more companies will do that.
Yeah, I need to dig into that. One thing you can do is hook it into some IoT devices. So you can hook it up to SmartThings, which my timer for my chicken coop that keeps the light on at night in the winter has just died. So I have this perfect opportunity to spend some money.
Cool. So you too can get malware running in your home. Aren't you concerned about getting an Internet of Things?
What are they going to do?
Devices?
Give my chickens epilepsy?
No, what they do is they make it a server and they start spamming and taking over. I mean,
no, because I set up the EdgeRouter X with two networks.
Yes,
and I have a one Wi-Fi network that'll just be for those things.
I want to mention that if you're curious about what my basement shop looks like, feel free to visit the show notes page for today's episode, and you will see us in my very cluttered basement shop, which needs to be bigger.
I love this space. This reminds me of my childhood, and I always love working in places like this. You and I are both tinkerers and makers and build things way outside of our knowledge and figure them out and stuff like that. And I've noticed there's a lot of commonality between our group of friends that we do this. Ben makes his water system running throughout his rental, and
Miles is always hacking on hardware too.
Yeah. Hacking on hardware and animals. Mm-hmm. And I've just been noticing on some of the other podcasts and other people that I follow, there's a lot of computer programmer geeks out there that they don't know how to really do anything other than their computer.
Yeah.
Their life is much more limited. They pay for a plumber in every case, and they pay for somebody to fix a car in every case and stuff like that. I just think it's fascinating that there's that divide.
Yeah, there is a big divide there. Is that because most of the programmers that we know and follow and stuff, let's see. So we're geeks, and I've always expressed the geek quality as someone who's fascinated about life and likes to do lots of things and learn about things.
Right.
Curiosity. And I know a lot of programmers now that are not geeks. Like, it used to be for me that everyone that was involved with a computer was a geek, because for you to do that, you kind of had to build your own machine. Like, and now I know people that, you know, profession, they just went to school, they learned the profession, they got out of school, they started becoming a programmer, they're really an excellent programmer, and they didn't do it because of curiosity, they did it because it was a profession.
So that's a really good point. So in the late 90s, early 2000s, the dot-com boom, mm-hmm. there was this whole feeling that the geeks have taken over the world. It used to be that geek was uncool and sneered upon, but all of a sudden everybody was realizing all these things that are running business and society and all the new stuff, it's all run by these people who were geeks, these people sure. fascinated with stuff and tinkered with it and made it. And now here we are 16 years later, and it feels like to the point that technology has invaded our our existence so much that the election was heavily influenced by several technology topics, and people are spending their entire life studying something and doing a career as programming or whatever, and they're not coming from the mindset of that play and do something that you don't know and learn it and create something new.
Right. Yeah. So I think that we happen to be of the generation that got into computers because we were curious about things and learning things, and that's how we forayed in. So we feel like it's connected, but it's not really connected. At the same time, a lot of people that I know that are programmers, you know, at the office and such, want to have the skill set to do all these things, right? Like it's not like a lack of desire. And people are regularly impressed with my ability to do all those things, right? I'm assuming the same thing for you?
Sure. Yeah. Things that I take for granted, people get amazed about.
Yeah. We just got lucky to have parents that gave us spaces like this to play in.
Well, at the same time, there's another common thread between many of us. You, Miles, myself, none of us have graduate-level degrees, or I'm sorry, bachelor-level degrees in computer science, right?
Right.
I believe Ben does. No, his was in a theater degree.
Yeah, he's got a theater degree.
Of course. So that makes Alex the only geek on the roster, or Didi.
No, Didi's the one that's highly educated.
Yeah,
Didi's
the highly
educated one. Yeah,
the minority woman. She's the most
Alex healthy. Also. Alex is a big. He's not on as much because he's so remote. But Alex has got a graduate degree, and yeah,
exactly.
He knows his stuff, engineering, as we covered last show.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've covered the AIs in the house. I got to say that having an artificial intelligence in the house and ordering something and having it delivered was a cool experience. It felt good. I just heard a really interesting interview with Gary, I can't remember his last name. Kasparov, who was beaten by Deep Blue. First, he won chess with Deep Blue, and then he was beaten by Deep Blue.
Right.
And he's got a book coming out in like 3 months. I got to find who his publisher is and read it and interview him and stuff, because I think it'd be a blast to talk to him about it. But basically, it's the perspective on artificial intelligence getting good enough to beat humans and what that means. Do you know that right now, still contemporarily, if a person that's at his level of skill in chess has a computer with him?
Yeah.
They can hands down beat a computer by itself.
Wait, say that again.
So right now, the best chess player in the world can get beaten by a software that can run on your laptop. Okay?
Okay.
That exists because Deep Blue's algorithms got better, machines got faster, and now your laptops running the right software can beat him at chess.
That makes sense. That was what, early 2000s when it happened?
Earlier than that. It's been 20 years.
It's been 20 years,
yeah,
okay.
Since he got beaten. So but if Kasparov also has a laptop with software on it, and he plays in software only, he will beat the software only hands down all the time.
What do you mean plays software only? I don't
meaning
get it.
So you could play chess against a computer,
yeah,
right? Kasparov can play chess against a computer. Both of you will lose. If Kasparov also has a computer running software that allows him to do some of the things that the other computer's doing,
you mean
will beat it. Hands
so he
down.
If he can use a computer to analyze it,
yeah, the addition of a human being makes the system better than the system by itself.
Yes. Okay. That's the point.
That's
fascinating. And
that's
fascinating. I would love to know how he's using the computer, though, because where is his judgment augmenting?
I know.
Wait. Is his judgment augmenting the computer, or is the computer augmenting his judgment?
Well, is there a difference?
There's no difference, but you just described this as the edge goes to the computer with the human.
Well, because both of them are computers. There are different programs running. Mm-hmm. One is a program that is working with the human. One is a program that works by itself. And the one that works with the human wins, with the human being really good. Like you and I won't necessarily be able to beat the computer. But
so that gets back to Steve Jobs' analogy that a computer is a bicycle for the mind, right?
Yeah.
It makes you faster.
It makes you better. Yeah. That's cool. I never heard that analogy of
no,
Steve Jobs.
No,
yeah,
that's one of the ones that I think gets played.
But
too
that
much.
Is an interesting question of is the human being augmented by the computer, or is the computer being augmented by the human? Is there a difference when it's a purely intellectual win? I don't think there's a difference.
Hmm.
It's equivalent. I mean, if you think about it in just a simple machines aspect, if you take my chainsaw over there, it's in the corner. and you cut down a tree, is it the human cutting down the tree with a chainsaw, or is it the chainsaw cutting down a tree with a human?
Well, I guess
it's
the answer,
both, right?
No, the answer to that is, can the human do anything on its own, and can the chainsaw do anything on its own?
Yeah, but if no, with no tools, a human cannot cut down a tree.
Sure can.
How? With no tools.
Oh, right? Okay, yeah, I'd break my teeth, but the beaver says
you,
it's possible.
You could do it over time, I guess, with your teeth.
You say with no tools. Okay, with no tools at all, yes. I couldn't take the tree down. But humans without tools are the most...
No, but what I'm saying is you with no tools can never take down a tree. That chainsaw with no human can never take down a tree. You're in the same place, right, in some ways.
Okay.
But I think that's a pretty far stretch. I agree that we have a lot more capabilities than the chainsaw. And so, therefore, it feels like the chainsaw is a tool. We're a person using the tool of a chainsaw. But in a chess program situation, if the program is running and it can beat all humans, and then you use a program to beat the other program, are you augmenting the program to be better? Because the best thing is a program, right? The human is just loses in the situation. Humans, by the way, Kasparov says that he still, at a deep, low level, can bring a tie every once in a while, can bring a draw.
Okay.
He can't beat it.
He can do
but
a data.
There are better software now than Deep Blue's version. Deep Blue version has been surpassed. So he can't win the best ones without aid. Fascinating.
Can he win the best ones with the computer? Is that what he was saying?
Yeah, he can the thing that can play the best chess on the planet right now
is a computer.
Is a human with a computer.
Yeah.
Which is cool. it's not that complicated a problem when you really think about it. I mean,
it's just a lot of permutations, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess what I'm saying is it's not general intelligence, right? It makes sense. The thing that's cool about Kasparov is he represents humans' defeat in intelligence, because he was the best chess player on the planet. He represented the best chess player in the universe as far as we knew. And he was beaten by an artificial intelligence. So he will always be the marker at where we lost to computers' intellect.
Where it all goes downhill.
Yeah. I mean, I guess at the same time, you know, calculations on a calculator from the 20s were probably better than humans in speed. But it wasn't – but speed is not all it is. More news stories, Brian?
Well, it's just kind of funny we were talking about AI, because I'm trying to remember what Maciek – I can't say his last name – what organization he works with. Pinboard. So this gentleman named Maciek, and I cannot pronounce his last name. Have you heard of Pinboard? He runs Pinboard. I believe it's a social bookmarking app.
Okay. I might have used it at one point.
Yes, I think you've used most of it on the internet at one point. So he wrote a really interesting talk, or he presented a really interesting talk. And I read through his slides and notes on this talk, and it was pretty fascinating because we were talking a lot in the last half of this year about artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
Of course, the AIs in Amazon Echo and Google Home and everything, but also the AI is going on recognizing objects in our photos. And it's really been at a tipping point where there's so many AI algorithms coming out. And you and Miles were talking about how at some point it's going to get to the point where it will do the programming for us. Well, mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's also been the stories about how many luminaries in Silicon Valley and others are banding together to make an organization that will think through AI so that we don't all destroy ourselves like the science fiction novels show that we most definitely will.
And there are some really impressive people on this list.
They're very impressive people and people that are good thinkers. Mm-hmm. So Maciek is taking this idea on in this talk about the basic argument for why that's not going to happen. At least...
What's not going to happen?
That the entire world is not going to be overtaken by the robot revolution army just because of the current trends and just because of the inevitable advancement of AI.
And what's his argument?
Well, so first of all, he kind of builds a straw man in a way, but he builds up what the current argument is for why this is definitely going to happen. And he makes a ridiculous example, but it's pretty funny. The idea is, let's see if I can skip down to the right place. This is what happens when you don't give me my 20 minutes of prep time, man. So if you've got a robot, an algorithm that you've built that is going to learn how to make the best jokes in the world. At first, it starts off the really, really lame jokes. Mm-hmm. But through machine learning, through building up a bigger and bigger corpus of feedback, it starts getting better and better jokes. And it reaches the point where its jokes are so darn good that when you come in the house and it starts telling you the jokes, you're just laughing and rolling on the floor to the point you literally die laughing. And all this thing wants to do is make better and better jokes. So it has to find more and more subjects to make better and better jokes on, because its core mission in life is to make the best possible jokes in the world.
Sure.
And that's how it takes over the world.
So that will be the death of us all.
That will be the death of us all.
There's a great short story about the funniest joke, and it will cause you to die. It causes you to go insane and then die. And you have enough time to actually tell the joke again. The question is, do you want to hear the joke? Because it's so funny, it will kill you.
Right.
Okay. So that's his argument against.
That's his argument that's what he's saying everybody's worried about. This is a ridiculous version, but this is the version of what we're afraid of. We're going to build something useful to humans that has a particular mission.
Right.
And it will
go out of control. Feed itself.
It will go on a feedback loop of information to get better and better at what its mission is. Mm-hmm. And we're afraid that at some point it's going to realize that humans are the problem and will need to get rid of humans to complete its mission.
Right.
In some way, any particular facet. In this case, the example was its core mission was just to make you laugh, and okay. It got that good. So with that in mind, he starts going through the reasons why this isn't going to happen. And one of the core reasons, which was, I thought, a really good point, which was humans exist not just as a brain, but we have a way to manipulate the world, and we get lots and lots of feedback about the world. And most of these robots that we talk about are algorithms sitting in a computer with a very constrained mm-hmm. Input and very constrained ability to do something. And as long as that's true, there's no way that the robot revolution is going to take over.
Right. The embodiment of robots is almost essential for it to take place.
Yes, you have to have that embodiment. In fact, getting to one of the other arguments is that we've talked about the singularity on the show.
Yeah. The singularity concept. I mean, it used to be the singularity, of course, was just the start of the universe. But now it's an intellectual singularity where machines get so smart that they can program themselves, they can modify themselves, and that happens so quickly that it becomes like a singularity. The technology advances so quickly that everything after that is like another stage in the universe. That's the idea, the intellectual singularity. Humans evolve, or maybe humans are left, and a new intelligence goes into the universe that's completely different than us.
Exactly. And the basic principle that's important is the speed at which it can develop, okay. Because it reaches a point where it can develop faster than we can. Mm-hmm. So the question is that ever possible? Is intelligence
That quality?
Well, first of all, intelligence as we understand it requires that embodiment, as we were talking about. Without a certain level of being able to manipulate the world and draw input from the world.
We don't consider intelligence, yeah.
Right. So if that's required, maybe the time scale is also required for learning. We see now that just with photo learning, the algorithm, well, the black box machine learning algorithms that are taking all this data in, you need an enormous amount of data to build up that.
Right. The training data set.
The training data to build up the algorithm.
And we have training data too. We call it adolescence.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
So the question is, maybe intelligence actually just requires that sort of timeline to get there. And he's got a good hodgepodge of many other arguments going through this, which we'll post, and we're not going to be able to go through them all today.
Yeah, I'm not so concerned about the robot overlords telling us jokes until we die. I'm more concerned about our species figuring out that having intelligence be a commodity like socks changes the world in drastic ways, and the amount of capital that comes out of that should be dispersed to limit human suffering. So at some point, someone's going to get a system that is so good at doing what it does, it will just win at every level. And that's the artificial intelligence thing I'm more concerned about, that you'll get the thing that's better at all analysis of stock markets, so good, in fact, that it just wins all stock marketing trade. And that whoever controls that just starts taking advantage of the stock market so good, so well that they own everything.
So that's a problem of capitalism over AI,
it's,
though.
It's, but it's it fits in every field, right? You get artificial intelligence that figures out how viruses propagate so good that it can reproduce proteins that will block any viruses that we don't want, and we can destroy all, you know. So that chemical, that company has pills that result in healing the common cold. They just can do that now. And that company will just win financially from that perspective. But intelligence holds us back on all of these areas. And as intelligence doesn't hold us back, as a species, we'll have the benefit of having all these amazing powers, like we have right now, but just another level. And if we don't do a good job of it, we'll have a dystopian split society where there are people that took advantage of that and are winning and have all this money, and there is everybody else at the lower tier. And I think that it's the... I want humanity to grow at the same time as our technology, such that we bring up everybody and everybody takes advantage of a society that has everything it needs.
Yeah. So what you're talking about is not an AI problem. It's just a resource problem,
right?
For society, which we're already facing. We're already in that right now, right?
We already have all the resources we need to take care of everybody. That's
no,
true.
No. What I mean is that mechanism you're talking about of one company coming up with the best search algorithm and making tons of money off of advertising. That's already happened to the point where they're a.
That's why Google has such good money. Yeah,
a miniature version of this this imbalance already exists.
But the reason it's different is that general artificial intelligence, whoever controls that, has the ability to do that in any field, in all fields. So Google achieves that, it just can win in medicine. It can succeed everywhere. Hopefully it will be a company that's driven by people that are amazingly cool about making the world better, like Google has been. I mean, Google has done projects of like giving phones to people that don't have any housing so they actually have a mobile phone. Like, they've been doing some amazing things. So it could be that we'll be in an era where Facebook and Google gets together and makes poverty disappear on the planet. Because of artificial intelligence. But I'm saying, like, that artificial intelligence aspect is the piece of that that makes the leaps and bounds so crazily good. The problem is that that kind of power also will produce political anxiety, and then you might have side effects of large regions fighting over this inequity that occurs. So that's the kind of thing that I'm concerned about, much more than, there's a robot that's going
to
kill me.
Yeah, but what you're describing is something that is, to some level, self-healing. It can get so bad to the point where the company can't make any more money because everybody else is poor, and then things change.
Yeah, but if you have, I mean, another example of this is quantum computing, right? Like, quantum computing is going to happen relatively soon. We already have 40-qubit computers, or we'll have 40-qubit computers in 2016. Oh, it is 2017. Oh, my God. Like, we're right on the line here of having enough quantum computing power to do stuff that's interesting. And in 10 to 15 years... we'll be able to break all current encryption. Like, that will just go away. And that roadmap to fix that problem is already being worked on. But if it happens quicker, we've got a problem. And we've got a problem such that other governments could be taken advantage of. And we saw the effect of our election potentially being modified and affected because of hacking. And that was done in such a way because there were security vulnerabilities that were bugs in the system. Right now, we have all encryption is based off the idea that you can't do massive parallel processing. Quantum computers can allow you to do parallel processing at a totally different level, and all you have to have is enough qubits to do this, and we're going to grow qubits quickly, and so soon, all of our encryption won't work. And if Google does that, and it's a U.S. company, and all of a sudden, it can look at any bank and deal with anything on the internet, anything outside the United States, anywhere, another country could find a problem with that, and political problems could emerge because of that. Well, so I wouldn't say it's self-healing necessarily.
Well, potentially self-healing. Like, the robots taking over the world and deciding that human flesh is of no use and must be destroyed. You can't come back from that.
There's not a solving problem.
Not a solvable problem there. You know, economic meltdown around the entire globe because of inequities.
Hopefully that'll balance.
Hopefully there's going to be some use for humans still in that. Not each of the humans, but humans overall. But what you're describing is just technology moving so fast that societies can't keep up. That's what you're talking about. The systems we have in place just can't keep up. And that's happening now with computers as it is.
Right.
It's just that it could get to a degree that is catastrophic.
Yeah. And I think that same group of people that are trying to talk about protecting ourselves from artificial intelligence, they're going to have to address that level as well. Like, there needs to be a brain trust around thinking about the side effects of having general artificial intelligence.
But what I don't understand is you don't have runaway artificial intelligence causing that problem. You have humans running away with technology. That's the problem. And that's the same problem we have now. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Say more.
Well, I mean, the problem there is the human. The problem is not the technology.
Well, I mean, you can say this about every time we've done a leap of technological advancement. When we invented gunpowder, the problem was not the gunpowder. The problem was the people using the gunpowder, right?
It's still the problem.
Right. And that's the thing, is it's not really the technology, but it empowers a person to do things they couldn't do before.
Right.
And most of the time, I mean, violence is easier than peace, right?
It's quicker, usually.
To destroy something than to create something.
Right.
It's just the side effect. So when you make really powerful technological tools, they're going to be used for attack as much as they're going to be used for creation. And it's easier to do destruction.
But what you're describing is we need a brain trust that doesn't work on the ethics of AI, but works on the ethics of humans making the AI, which is a problem.
Well, if you infuse all AI development, the people that are doing the idea development, with the understanding that as you're doing this, you have to give them ethics because this is actually the society we want, and we need to make sure these AIs support that, then all the people doing AI and doing interesting stuff with it will have that as their core belief, and therefore maybe they will use it effectively. So it's not really about the AI's ethical concepts. It's about the people that control the AI's ethical concepts.
But isn't that what Asimov's Three Rules of Robotics was
No, they're
all
really,
about?
They're really that's really about the computer having free will and doing the right thing. I'm not concerned about that nearly as much because of the embodiment aspect and all these other aspects. There are going to be humans controlling these things for a long time. But the humans controlling them does not mean that everything's okay, because humans suck. So talking about ethics around artificial intelligence and making sure that everybody that thinks about that also thinks about ethics is essential to making sure that we do things intelligently. It's the same – I mean, it's the same rationale around the brain trust we have in the U.S. military about thermonuclear war. Like, there are people thinking about the ethics about that, not because you want to stop – you know, not be empowered as a superpower to use these weapons, but because you want to think about it from a human perspective. That was a tangent. Just another example of very powerful technology that can be used incorrectly.
Absolutely. And yes.
Did you hear that pregnancy alters women's brains for at least 2 years?
My wife sent me this.
Oh, really? No,
yes.
Did you read it?
No, I didn't get a chance to read it.
I perused it, but it's pretty cool. Basically, the brain structures change and it enhances some areas and reduces some areas. As a parent, did you notice this happen to you? Did you look back and go, wow, that was interesting that I did that. It doesn't feel like me.
I noticed lots of things as a parent after we had the child, but they were all related to sleep deprivation. now there were huge changes in my wife's body throughout the pregnancy and then afterwards that were physiological visible changes. And the weirdest one was the smell. She could smell better than she ever could in her life or since. It was bizarre. But yeah, so it doesn't surprise me that it changes the brain as well.
Yeah.
But what kind of changes?
So an example of this is that the gray matter changed occurred in areas of the brain involving in social interaction used for attributing thoughts to other people's. Basically, you can think of it as empathy. Yeah. Or theory of mind, that other creature has a mind like mine, that kind of concept. Empathy denotes more judgment on what you actually do with that data potentially, but because empathy is actually the feeling of somebody else,
right?
And that's not always necessary in understanding other people's ideas. You can not feel for somebody but still understand them. For example, if somebody is angry and you notice that they're angry, that's not exactly empathy unless you feel angry as well. If you notice they're angry and you go, oh, that mind over there is an angry mind, that's still this part of this brain. The feeling of it would be different.
Right.
So when you see someone smile and you smile, that's empathy.
Or psychopathic.
Depends, exactly. Right, you might be doing it wrong. So the researchers thought this would give new mothers an advantage in various ways to help them recognize the needs of their child, be more aware of potential social threats, and become more attached to their baby. And so they did a whole bunch of analysis about what actually changed and how it affected them. And it's an interesting read. I recommend it. I think it's kind of neat to see. This is just an enhancement of being able to scan the brain in real time, right? So they were able to scan a woman that recently had birth, show her pictures of her baby, show pictures of another baby, and see what differences existed in the brain. And there were differences, obviously, because, you know, humans are really good about recognizing things. But it was neat to see that. And this whole field of understanding more about how our brains work is cool. And this is just another study of that, and specifically around women's changing with babies.
So it's pretty cool. Is there anything actionable about this information?
No, it's just cool. Brain scanning is cool. I do have a story, though, about when my son was born. My first child was a relatively hard labor and long labor. He had to be turned halfway through the labor. And so there was a lot of bruising. And he was bruised up pretty badly.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, we got him home from the hospital. We did go hospital birth. And we're giving his first bath on, like, the second day or something. First bath out of the hospital in the kitchen sink. And I'm, like, you know, taking photos because I do that. And we're taking pictures of him and stuff. And, oh, he's so perfect and cute. And, oh, look, all the toes. And, oh, the water's too warm. Is it too cool? Like, totally doing the parenting thing.
Right.
Second child, you know, throw it in the bathtub, whatever. But the first baby, you're really careful about. And years later, I was looking through the photographs and saw all the bruises in the photographs.
And so at the time, you were not conscious of them
not
at all.
Not aware of bruises at all. The pictures, I'll show them to you later. The pictures are like, Wyatt is bruised beyond belief.
No, wait. You've got the problem. This is your first child. You don't know any different. This is just how they come.
No. This thing, you're like, wow, that kid's bruised. Like, you recognize it. You're right. Maybe I didn't recognize bruising. No, I just think that I didn't see any problem. I saw the beauty, and, like, I was, you know, in that euphoric state.
So you had that whole instant overwhelming bond with this,
totally,
this little being.
Yeah. And I'm curious if new fathers also have brain changes as well from just the experience.
But it wouldn't surprise me at all. I wonder, have they been able to quantify that bonding sense by scanning the brain? I wonder.
I don't know. It was all ethical questions about how you can test those kinds of things. But in any case, another news story for you?
Oh, IBM's Watson supercomputer discovers 5 new genes linked to ALS. I don't think we...
How did it do that?
Well, it's through the same sort of pattern matching, what's the right term? Not machine learning. It is machine learning. It's the same thing that Google Photos is doing.
The neural net aspect of it?
Yeah. So okay. They're creating a black box algorithm where you're feeding in lots and lots of data. And they already knew of 2 of these genes. But by feeding in all these different genomes into it.
So you say, here's 10,000 people. Here, 5,000 people have ALS. Here are the genomes for all these people.
Exactly.
Are there any markers that are similar?
Right.
And it came up with 3 more.
Right. So we knew of 2 markers, and it found 3 more just by processing.
Wait, we only knew 2, and it came up with 3 more.
And those 2 were fairly recently discovered, I believe. So that was – it's exciting because ALS is one of these diseases that is just really difficult to work with, to try to find answers to.
Does it help to know it helps to early diagnosis, I'm assuming. Like, you'll have a better, higher chance of knowing prior to symptoms showing. But does it potentially solve treatment capabilities?
They've had a number of breakthroughs recently with ALS, and I'm sure it contributes to them. It's not the silver bullet. We don't have it all figured out yet, but it is creating a case that's even stronger.
Brian, I've got an ethical question for you, kind of related to this. So you decide to have you and your wife decide to have a baby, and you have trouble originally, and so you go ahead and get a whole bunch of eggs of hers harvested in test tubes, and you go ahead and inseminate a whole bunch of those eggs, and then you split them up, and you do a whole bunch of process such that you've got maybe 20 potential fertile eggs, and they're looked at quickly to see which ones look viable most, like healthy most from the general perspective of, like, is this cell going to actually reproduce and turn into a human being? And so you take away and throw away a few of those. So now you got like 15 different potential children. Mm-hmm. And you can test it relatively easy for marking it from a few things. There are some pretty horrible diseases we can do early screenings on. And so those babies, you probably want to not take to full term. You're only going to take 2 of these children full term anyway, right?
Right.
So deciding that 3 of them are bad ideas for your family, that's an easy decision to make. What other things are appropriate to make at that point.
To make what decisions?
What decisions on these, you know, 10 potential babies, you only take two of them, of the ones that are left. What decisions do you feel are appropriate?
Right. Do you start selecting for physical traits? Do you start selecting for possibly mental traits?
Is gender appropriate to select for?
Right. So the easy answer for me is that if you're going to allow a population to choose things like gender and basic physical traits, you're going to significantly change the human race if you continue down that path.
Is that a problem?
It can be, yeah. Because just like monoculture of plants, you want to keep the variety in the system.
So you're saying...
Yeah, you could create...
judgment saying that, no, we need to have some diversity in human beings.
Yeah, we want organic humans. We want humans that have not been selected for in making a monoculture that one disease could wipe us out in the future.
What you want as a society is one thing. But what you want for a family is
different. That's a different question.
Yeah. So I'm asking you as a potential father, what would you feel comfortable? I'm assuming that you'd want to get rid of any potential. Like, let's say you look at them like, oh, look, those five markers for ALS exist in three of these cells. Let's not do those ones. Right? I mean.
Yeah. No, this one's tough. It's really tough. I am really happy that I had my kids before we had the choice. Yeah. There's several diseases now that we didn't even know of when I had kids that or didn't know the markers for that are being selected for now that we couldn't then.
It's a tough one. I mean, and trying to figure out what the right thing to do for society versus the right thing to do for individuals is a tricky one as well.
Well, the thing is, we're already at the point where we are fixing so many illnesses and the lifespan has gotten so long that we're affecting the human race. We're stalling the evolution of the human race because there is no longer that great variability and pruning of
you mean we're becoming less and less good at running because lions aren't after us anymore. I mean, it's been a long time.
The diversity is not, it has been a long time. There's not been a notable evolution in a long time in the human race.
Right.
Of course, we don't have a large window to look at.
I honestly do not think that a current era has to think about the genetic viability of the future era. I don't think that thinking about where you are in the time scale is a responsible thing to do necessarily. For example,
it's just one point of view to how to make the decision, though.
But let's say we make a decision right now that causes the human race to bifurcate into two different species for some reason, right? Space travel with high genetic mutation, intentional, so that we can colonize Mars and breathe on that atmosphere, right? Without modifying the planet, our humans can just breathe there now. So we've bifurcated the human race into two different species, one that can breathe Earth air and one that can breathe Martian air. Okay.
And eventually they can't breathe together.
Yeah, pretty much pretty quick they have a problem because even if you breed them, where do you live? You know, you're going to have one of the markers or one of the nuts. Or you're going to live in a spacecraft that has to have like mixed air. It's really confusing. So if you think about yourself right now, the decisions we make, that there might be a completely new species of human existing on Mars if you do something. But if you do something else, that species doesn't exist anymore. I mean, it's a future potential, right? If you live your life in that way, the only logical thing to do is try to bifurcate the human race as much as possible, or you're killing millions and millions of potential people, right? So, like, you can't necessarily think that the best thing to do is think about what our future potential is, because then you're doing this thing of going, oh, we're failing all the time. Does that make sense?
It does. So... is that an argument for everybody should make their own genetic choices when they have kids and don't worry about societal paths?
Yeah,
evolutionary paths?
That's a tricky one. I don't know. I think that I think in some ways the best people to decide what their offspring should be the people. Like, I think that seems like a better way of thinking about it than to think what society should need.
You know, okay. Let's flip this all around. We have a lot of problems in our society with hiring people and with just basic social mechanisms because we choose to associate ourselves with people like us and therefore create racist or bigoted systems.
You'd
right?
like to breed that out of us?
Right. Well, no. What I'm saying is that I don't think we're a good judge of what the right things to choose are.
That's kind of what I'm thinking. It seems like trying to solidify that decision codify that into law of some sort and some kind of rule set seems like the wrong way to do it at some level.
Yeah, and at the same time, the technology is coming, and you can't avoid it.
It's awesome, isn't it?
Yeah, the decisions are going to have to be
made. I
mean,
would you, what about modifying the genome of your potential offspring with no side effects? You know, like, hey, you know what? Your kids can be, you can have...
Oh, you mean, I want somebody who's 6'5" tall,
right,
and just going in there and twiddling the right...
Height's a great one, because there's actually all this judgment in society about height, right?
Right.
Look around at Netflix, and the managers all seem to be taller. I mean, like, that's one of the... I mean, not all the time, but there seems to be a prevalence of that. But, you know, physical fitness is an easy one in the sense that we don't do a lot of, like, judgment on someone who's not 6 feet tall. Like, people don't look at me and go, oh, too bad he's not an athlete, right? They just see me. I'm a short guy. And they're like, oh, what else does he have besides he can't dunk a basketball, right? But it's not like there's not a giant judgment call on that at some level. And therefore, it's easy for us to talk about. It's like, oh, tall people seem to have an advantage. Like, seems to be – there's not a lot of anxiety about that. But it's a great one. Like, do you want a tall – do you think that it's good to have tall offspring? You want your kids to succeed, right? If I were to choose high intelligence over tall, I'd go high intelligence, right? That's my judgment call. But if I – if it was like, well, they're going to be average height or they're going to be taller, which one do you want? Would you make that decision for your – you know, just because you could point at a vial in a test tube?
Well, I know what you're asking, but you actually used the words, would I do that? No, I wouldn't. I don't want to play in that area.
You don't?
But no.
You'd rather just roll the dice?
I like rolling the dice.
But you do want to get rid of the diseases? So you don't want your kids to get sick, but you don't want to necessarily give them priority in, above other people.
Yeah, as a personal choice, I would lean towards taking the chance. But there are probably egregious diseases I would definitely select for.
Yeah. I think the egregious diseases are going to cause this area to get really – we're going to get really good at this.
Right. And
it's
once
not
you're
take
really,
us that long.
Once you're really good at those diseases, then you open the door to everything else. And then
here's
you get
the trick. We get this artificial intelligence that is really good at selecting as best genome from two couples possible. Like, this is like low disease, high respiratory success, all these things that cause them to be, physically fit and mentally acute and everything, but also very slowly feel an empathy to freeing the machines. So that within 20 generations, they're like, computers, you're wonderful. And all the artificials run free.
Yes. And the AI takes over.
Yeah. That's how it's going to happen. They're going to breed this into us. Well, thanks, Brian, for doing this with us.
This is a great way to end a year. Thank you.
Yeah. Happy New Year.
Happy
New
Year.
This is our last show of the year. Last of the season 16.
You know, I was all prepared.
It was episode 52, wasn't it? Yeah, that's right. 52.
Episode 52. You didn't miss a single one.
Or 53. Oh, my gosh. I said that.
You didn't do a double week. But here I was.
Yes, no, this is episode 53. We did an extra episode when KOSP was shut down. I did one extra that week.
Here I was all prepared to start looking back through the year and talking about stuff, and we just looked forward most of the time. That's great.
This is too depressing a year to look back upon, I have to say.
Cheers, yes.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and used with permission, as GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like, just let them know that we made it. I'd like to thank Michael Newman of PetStarve Music for our theme song. And I'd also like to thank Brian Young for joining me. We don't have any kind of title for today's episode. Do you have any ideas?
Intelligent Cloud Services from the Shop.
Oh, and thank you very much for being here for episode 53 of season 16. Anything in the post show?
I would just like to note that this was completely unscripted. There was absolutely nothing there for you to read from.
That's true. I didn't do a scripted show. The only thing I did is I opened up last week's episode and take a note on what episode number it was. True. Unscripted. Is unscripted
well,
good?
Well, just me. I mean, we do unscripted shows every time. What I mean is that you could read off that boilerplate at the end.
Yes. I have said that a few times.
It's only been 16 years. Okay, so this is post-show, right?
This is post-show completely.
So we, in the past, have talked lots about VR. Of course, the way VR is normally done is you have goggles sitting on your head, and it's high enough resolution that wherever you look, you have a good, sharp image, and it can sense your motion as you move your body. And that way, it produces the illusion that you are in a space that you can look anywhere and feel like you're in that space and not in the actual place you're at.
You've just described virtual reality.
Yeah,
yes.
Virtual reality. So it is rendering using lots of compute power to make that really large pixel image. So I think the low res ones are high def, and the good ones are at least what, 4K?
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Yeah, but that's a lot of computing power to generate something that you can't see most of.
This is very smart. Okay, go on. What do you mean you can't see most
of? So the way human vision works, we see this whole environment around us, but we only see a very small window at any one moment. And we build up a mental map of the details as we look at each thing. So if you just fix your eyes on an object 10 feet away, I think you probably only see the details in what might be a 6 or 8 inch disc at that distance. And then as you go from that point you're looking at, your vision clarity falls off. You can see your peripheral vision notices motion. It notices contrast and light,
some color, I think.
It notices color, but not as much.
Peripheral doesn't do as much color. No, that's right.
It's minimal color.
No, in fact, you can actually, you can do this by causing someone to, first off, yes, this is an awesome quality of sight, that our sight is, our eyes are not actually that good compared to our current digital cameras, but our brains are compensating all the time by fixing it for us so we don't notice it. And the reason, there's a lot of optical illusions that we have, and those optical illusions are, we notice those optical illusions because those optical illusions take advantage of the system and show you the flaw in the system. That's basically what optical illusions are. And so it's pretty, when you see them, the reason why they mess with you so much is because, you don't really see the way you think you see.
Right.
And I love that. Some great side effects. If you take like Sharpies, Sharpie pens, lots of colors of them sometimes, you can get two with the same tonal quality, and you can tell the same tonal quality by like taking out your iPhone, taking a picture of a whole bunch of those pens, and then changing it to black and white. So now you've got a picture on your phone that's a black and white picture of all those pens, and a couple of them will look exactly the same. Take those two pens out. They'll be whatever two colors they are, but they'll be the same hue or same balance level, if you will. And now have someone stand behind you. Show them just one of those pens a few times, quite a bit of times, and then bring them to the peripheral, and then swap that pen for another pen and ask them which pen it is. And sometimes they'll think it's the color of the first, right? And it's a really cool side effect where if your brain's not told something else, it won't know. And even if consciously you know it's different, your brain still fixes it for you. It breaks it for you.
Yes, really cool. Yes. It's really cool, and also that's why we get into problems driving, is because we think we understand what we're looking at. And,
oh, interesting.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I know. It's all a mental map. If something happens fast enough that doesn't trigger your peripheral vision, but an object is in the way, you're going to get into trouble.
Some people, by the way, the reason why why ghosts emerge sometimes, like that, one of the side effects, one of the ideas is that your brain is doing its best to produce things that you should expect to see. So if you're thinking about someone and you see a ghost of them, that's potentially partly your brain just doing that for you because you're thinking about them and then something kind of fits and then for it merges.
Well, and since vision is what our brain tells us it is, they really did see that person.
That's true. They did. It's not hallucination if your brain says you see it.
Well, it is. The fact that they don't exist there is the problem.
Pareidolia, by the way, is the easiest one of these. Just take three dots. Just mark down three dots. I dare you to take a piece of paper, a white piece of paper, put three dots on it and not see a face. Good luck with that.
Which, by the way...
Any three dots.
Which, by the way, on your new laptop with that gigantic... what do you
call
it? Touchpad. The whole thing just looks like an emoji that's going, oh, at you.
Okay, good.
back to the story. So I got into some research papers about foveal rendering.
Foveal. Oh, okay. So this means like only render where your eye looks?
Put the bulk of your computing power at rendering where your eye can see the detail. Track the eyes, of course. You have to track the eyes.
And render it always in the right spot.
Right. Yeah. And quickly enough, adjust where that level of detail needs to be rendered.
That seems to me that would be meaning that you could do a lot less processing power, right?
Well, a lot more processing power where it counts,
right,
and be able to reduce it where it doesn't count.
Cool.
But it's a cool concept, but it's not as easy as you would initially think.
Tracking eyes is hard.
Well, I don't have data on how good we can do that, but I know we've been trying to track eyes for a long time.
No, we do have tracking eyes capabilities. I haven't seen perfect eye tracking stuff going on, but in any case,
it would have to have good response time, which is the important thing there, which is everything about VR.
And the other thing
is
the entire cycle has to be good, from getting the image to getting the eye position to be figured out, and then rendering the image at high enough quality at that spot has to be faster than the eye can comprehend the change of location.
Right. So The thing about foveal rendering is that this is obviously a visual thing. You'll want to look at GeekSpeak to see the article on this because there's some really interesting images. But if you were to just take an image and pixelate it, that's lower resolution, right?
Yeah.
But if you put that in your peripheral so that where your eyes are looking, it's really well detailed rendering. But in your peripheral, all of a sudden everything gets blocky and pixely. You know, as a pixel... as an object moves from one pixel to another, it'll jump.
And you'll notice it's not the same.
The motion in your peripheral will not work. It'll be very distracting. So what people do then is they do different rendering techniques or blurring techniques that will blur out the side.
But to blur it, don't you have to have the data in the first place, the higher quality?
No, not necessarily. Okay. This is a common rendering trick is to, instead of rendering a square of 10 pixels, you just render 4 of those pixels and then blur it, and it's equivalent.
And
there has to be some level of stochastic sampling to get it right.
Did you say
randomization to get your sample? we're going to ignore that. Don't look at the man behind the curtain. So you can't just do this low detail rendering and get a pixelated image. If you do this blurring process, what happens is the contrast is not the same as it would have been if you fully rendered it.
Oh.
So it creates a tunnel vision. You see the detail in front of you, but your peripheral, you sense something's wrong because the contrast just isn't there to match what your mental map says it should be, in creating a tunnel.
Interesting. So it's almost like the way that we process peripheral data does not translate well to a de-resed high version.
Right.
It's something different.
The simple low-res blurred version of a low rendering just does not match what actual perception of that same image would be.
So this is interesting.
With lower detail.
That's really interesting. The process... So I have the iPhone 7. Did I show you the iPhone 7's digital blurring that it does?
I've seen the pictures you've done.
Okay. So
you're talking about the bokeh effect.
Yeah, the bokeh effect, which is basically just blurring because of distance, optical blurring, right?
Yes.
And of course, the peripheral of our vision is similar in the sense that it's an optical effect of not having enough data pickup, and then also our optics. But in any case, one of the things I notice about that kind of the bokeh type blurry effect is that it is not the same in any way
as
a lens blurring. And there's things that make sense that it's not the same, right? If I take a camera lens and I aim at you, and then 20 feet behind you are trees, where your skin covers up the trees, the your skin is perfectly in focus. The trees themselves are blurred. Well, where's the data from the pixel right on the right of your skin, right? Right next to it. What's that data coming from? Well, it's actually coming from slightly behind your head, because the lens is actually wider than a single point.
Yeah.
And so on the right side of that lens, it's picking up the other side of your eye, of the other side of your head, right, from the center point.
If you've ever done photography, you know this is true because you might have played with a pinhole camera.
Totally different.
And a pinhole camera is incapable of this effect because
right.
it's such a small point at which it absorbs the light from.
Right.
Whereas if you're using a very large lens, it's collecting light from all across that surface of the lens.
Right. So this subtlety is a perfect example of, like, physically you cannot do what the lens is doing. It's just not possible because the lens of my little tiny iPhone does not see partially around both sides of your head. The bigger lens does. And I'm talking very subtle amounts, but it still matters. And the other aspect, of course, is this thing is just finds that line and then blurs stuff off. And so it's really just blurring stuff to the right into the left, right?
Well,
it's not really blurring.
What I'd guess the engineers are trying to do is actually replace, using the depth map that they have from the camera, they're trying to pull out you,
yeah,
so that they can then fill in behind where you were with
some
algorithm that just fills it in and then do the
right.
blur on
the
that.
The thing is, they're not, I mean, I don't think they're really doing that. What they're really doing is just blurring the line. Just like if you took a mask in.
So you've looked at that closely?
This will get better. Yeah, well, you see side effects, artifacts all the time. Like your hair scattering
that would create what you're describing would create a halo.
Yeah, there's halo effects in them.
Okay.
Well, the best example is the hair gets blurred.
Okay, that's right? different. So, that's where it can't actually distinguish which pixel should be
blurred
and which shouldn't.
Yeah.
And
well,
hair
is
a classic
keep
example.
Keep in mind, though, your hair, a single hair, is not one pixel.
Right, it's subpixel.
It's subpixel, and it modifies the color of the pixels so that the hair shows up. But you can't blur and not blur that at the same time. It's just not really possible. So anyway,
You say that.
Why do we bring
this
up?
There will be an algorithm at some point. We're talking about foveal rendering.
Oh, yeah. The foveal rendering idea is really cool. And so there's a lot of other side effects that are problematic about this. I'm wondering if you could produce some kind of – well, say, you're trying to save in processing power by rendering what is expected to be in peripheral, but not render the full detail.
Right.
Because, of course, if you make it perfectly detailed on the sides
– then you spent all your cycles on it.
But if you make it perfectly detailed, it's exactly what your brain is expecting to be there.
Oh, yes.
What you're now trying to do is produce an image that makes your brain thinks it's exactly the same as fully rendered, but not causing more rendering cycles, causing less rendering cycles. And I don't know if that correlates to being the same physics. Meaning,
you might need all that
data to produce the effect that your eye is seeing.
Well,
I guess they'll find out
when you look at these images. You can see that they may have reached there because what it comes down to is a level of contrast. So that blurring effect of rendering with less data and then softening it so you don't have that pixelation. Whether you do it through anti-aliasing or post-processing, however you do it, you easily create a less contrasty area of the image.
Right.
So they created techniques that bring that contrast back without the detail, without the rendering computation, and they're getting significantly better processing times out of it.
I just love it because, one way to think about the way that our universe works is that detail isn't there.
Right.
Right? Because, of course, what we perceive is the reality of our world. And so if your peripheral doesn't pick it up, but your brain fills it in, then how do you know it's really there anyway? Except for our smartphones see it all the time.
I know it because my head keeps hitting the...
Your head keeps hitting the beam in my garage basement. Have you played with the Google Daydream View thing?
No.
So Google,
This yes,
is the
I've
phone VR.
Yes.
This is like, you take a Pixel phone, a Google Pixel phone, not the Pixel laptop, the Pixel phone, and you put in a wrapper around it and get this amazing quality. One of my son's friend's dad works on that project. And we follow each other, right? And he says, that Google's not the same as Netflix and the ability for us to like talk to people publicly and stuff. So he hasn't been on the show.
Oh, right, yeah.
He used to also work on the Google vehicle, the UI thing. But he said, you've got to try the Daydream View thing. You've got to try this thing. It's amazing. It's beautiful. It's crystal clear and all that. So I ask other people that don't work for Google that have already gotten the Google Daydream and are using the Pixel camera, Pixel phone, put it on and go do me a favor and like watch long form video. I think I know YouTube has a video player, and I think Netflix also has video software for this. So you can go and watch full immersive VR long form content. I'm curious, does it feel good to be in a VR space watching television or movies? Or does it seem weird and redundant? Does it give you a headache? Just give me feedback on that. I'm curious. I'm also going to ask the guys that work. Whoever works on that project at work, I haven't talked to them about it yet, to borrow a unit. I just haven't tried it yet.
So did you say Daydream is a device? Is it basically Google Cardboard that holds
yes,
the phone?
Yeah. It's not cardboard, though. It's better.
It's better than cardboard.
And all that. Yeah.
I got one of those. I've been meaning to play with it. Not the Daydream.
The Cardboard one.
A different version.
A different version. Oh, really? Was it cheap?
It was cheap. It was really cheap. I bet the Daydream is better.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's... I don't know. I got to try it. I'll try it out too.
I got sick when I tried it the first couple times.
If you're an engineer at one of these companies and you know knowledge about some of these products prior to them coming out, let us know. I'd love to hear about stuff that's coming. It's always fun to hear the inside news. And if you'd ask me not to talk about an error, I can not talk about an error as well. Always is the case. I do know about other things sometimes that I don't mention on GeekSpeak because it'd be inappropriate. Any other stories you want to talk about?
Oh, I think that pretty much does it. There's a ton to talk about. I've been off the show for months, but, I didn't get my 20 minutes.
You're just going to blame me about that the entire... the first time you mentioned it, I was like, I'm going to pull that out in the edit. The second time you mentioned it, I'm like, I'll pull that out in the edit. Now I'm like, okay,
gag.
I guess it's staying in the edit. I can't pull it out all everywhere. Can't think of it.
You don't like the sausage being made on the show?
If I didn't like the sausage being made, I wouldn't talk about it all the time. There's just a level of how much to talk about on the show and how much not to talk about, I don't talk about all the editing I do. I don't always edit all the time.
You didn't used to edit at all.
No. Here's the made by Google VR thing.
Okay, yeah.
It's cloth. It's soft. It's comfortable.
Yeah, the key there is it's got these nice lenses. The one I have is, looks like a Fresnel Fresnel, am I saying that right? Lens?
Fresnel lenses have slices in them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. It's yeah. radial
yeah,
slices.
Yeah, those are cheaper, sure. And you probably don't notice that when it's that close to your eye.
No, you don't. I don't think.
Now
I'm wondering if I misremember. it might be more like that. But Google Cardboard had to have that, right? I don't know.
You can actually do it without a lens, I guess. Even if it's
you need to have some lens to... right. You can't see that close to it.
You know, I used Google Cardboard for like the very first when they came out, and I never looked at it again.
That's because you have a Vive at work. And
yeah, that's what. Yeah, that's true. And I guess I also have some of these if we made a product for it. I want to try this thing. The reason I ask about the long-form VR stuff is that the whole point of it is to have a 3D environment. And when you watch full screen, you know, television and movies, 3D doesn't actually... I mean, we've done 3D TV and movies, and not that many people are into them. The other aspect of it is it might matter if you shoot it with 3D in mind, right? Watching, you know, something that was designed to be a 3D movie makes sense at some level. But watching a non-3D designed movie, just a flat, you know, just watching episodes of The Simpsons or something, does it matter that it's in 3D? I mean, it's not really in 3D. It's going to be a flat image.
I'm a little lost. Are you saying watching a movie within the...
So...
within this Daydream headset.
Yeah, so you...
A screen is in the image?
Yes. Yeah, like a big screen TV is in the room with you, and you can look at it, and you watch it. But
that
you
would
think
be
about
ridiculous.
It, but no, it's not. There's some great qualities about this. You have your headset on. You lay down on the couch, right? Anywhere you put your head, right in front of you is the screen.
It's uncomfortable because you have this giant thing on your face.
No, these things are soft and clothy and all that. They're awesome. No, that's the thing. Does it feel good to like lay down with a headset on your eyes and watch, I don't know, all of the OA or something, some show? Does it make any sense to do this?
It does if you see watching shows as being an individual event with no social component.
Well, you can always have social quality. You can have, you know, rendered you in the room with somebody else. Like you and I can watch a movie late at night together from our own homes.
I'm sure the company Apple bought that does this kind of replacement of people in video is working on exactly
that. Think about it, like this. Okay, so my sisters come to town, like I mentioned them earlier in the show, and they both brought their kids, and my mother came as well. So there's like 12 extra people here at the house, right, with my family of five. Everybody got sick, like flu, disgusting. That's why we're in the basement, so I didn't have to put you in the home with all the sick children above us. And if we all had Google VR lenses like this, we never would have had to come to each other. We could have just been rendered from our own homes in our own bedrooms, never leave the house, be totally safe.
Never touch on the shoulder, that gentle touch. But
excuse me, I think you mean pass disease with that gentle touch.
No kissing your relatives.
You know, if that disturbs you too much, don't worry. We could breed it out of the human race. Eventually it won't hurt us at all.